So yes to research, no to including it in our policies today. And the geoengineering one is actually, I think, much more dangerous in many respects, though again I think it's important to have a research program on it. But the geoengineering is saying let's not really do quite so much on the mitigation. Let's rely on reflecting the sunlight back out, the sunlight and the heat back out into space, and therefore we can resolve the problem that way. And there are things like pumping sulfates into the stratosphere, rockets into the stratosphere to put sulfates there. They're putting enriching some of the oceans with iron to increase the uptake of the development of biomass, which absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But these things all interfere with sort of major global planetary systems that we don't fully understand. I think they're incredibly dangerous, but nevertheless, I think it's important to research those, but again, mitigate our emissions, reduce our emissions, assuming that they won't work either.
Finally, what effect does President Trump saying he's pulling the U.S. out of the climate agreement mean? You were critical of the climate agreement, and we just have 20 seconds for this part of our conversation, then we'll do part two.
There's a good part and there's a bad part. Pulling out sends a really bad signal, but in him pulling out, it has energized some other parts of the world to say, we will step in and do far more, including, of course, many U.S. mayors.
We're speaking with Kevin Anderson, the Zennström Professor on Climate Change Leadership at the Center for Environment and Development Studies, Uppsala University, also Chair of the Energy and Climate Change at the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at University of Manchester in Britain. We'll link to the report that he has co-authored. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll do part two as a web exclusive with Kevin Anderson.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sprig, presented by the Portland Folk Music Society, November 17th in Portland. Sprig is a gathering of musicians from all over the world who happen to come together in Portland. See how this quartet pulls their audience from Eastern Europe to the cafes of 1930s Paris and the dark hollows of Appalachia. Again, that's Sprig, presented by the Portland Folk Music Society, Friday, November 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. We don't want our fingers in the pot.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 5:02 and KBOO Evening News is coming up next.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit for the Portland Police Bureau's misconduct at the July 4th protest.
Trials began today for 200 protesters, journalists, and legal observers arrested at Trump's January 20th inauguration.
And a group of House Democrats today introduced 5 articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 15th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is getting sick of the federal budget.
Our leaders say we can't afford Medicare for all. We can't afford a better, less expensive education. We can't afford massive improvements in roads, water systems, etc., which would create tens of thousands of jobs. But yesterday, two-thirds of the Democrats in Congress and almost all the Republicans said we can afford $700 billion to the Pentagon. If you spent $1 million a day, it would take 1,900 years to spend that much. It's a lot more like organized crime than democracy. Taxes as protection money, school loan sharks, leaders creating the conditions that threaten our health with pollution, stress, and poverty so the doctors of big pharma can use their leeches to drain our bank accounts. If there was a vaccine to protect us from systemic capitalist greed, most of us couldn't afford it. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Oregon schools just broke a record, unfortunately, with more homeless students than ever, around 22,000 statewide. That's an increase of 5.6% since the previous year. The number of homeless students in Oregon has increased 20% in the past 3 years. Two local school districts have the most homeless students, Beaverton with around 1,500 or almost 4%, and Portland with around 1,500 or just over 3%. Multnomah County districts Reynolds, Park Rose, and Centennial showed percentages of 10, 8.5, and 8% respectively. Nine of the 10 districts with the highest rates of homelessness have fewer than 250 students. Butte Falls and Jackson County counted 56 homeless students, nearly 30% of total enrollment. Multnomah County's latest homeless count showed a 10% increase between February 2015 and February 2017, with more than 4,000 people in shelters or on the streets.
Maybe he intended it as a joke on the term stoned, but a Lane County resident has been arrested for making artificial boulders and stuffing them full of pot. Last week, Curran Manzer, 36, of Walter, made UPS shipments of over $1 million of pot to another state where marijuana is illegal. Springfield police would not comment about which state the boulders were sent to and said the investigation is ongoing. Manzer faces felony charges of illegally producing marijuana and money laundering, plus two related misdemeanors.
Monday was the 29th anniversary of the death of Mulegata Sarah, an event that gave Portland national negative attention. Sarah, a 28-year-old Ethiopian immigrant who drove a shuttle bus at the airport, was killed in 1988 when three Nazi skinheads crushed his head with a baseball bat on Southeast 31st Avenue. The Southern Poverty Law Center helped Sarah's family win a $12.5 million settlement against Tom Metzger, the head of White Aryan Resistance, an organization Sarah's assailants had spoken with the day before the killing. Sarah's death was just one of at least 40 murders by Nazi skinheads between 1988 and 1996, a number that doesn't include murders by other racist factions such as the Ku Klux Klan. A federally funded study says that almost 450 people, which many believe is a conservative figure, have been killed in the United States by the far right, which doesn't include police, since 1990.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit for the Portland Police Bureau's misconduct at the June 4th protest. They're targeting the PPB for their kettle technique, where over 200 people, including media and legal observers, were detained and their information was obtained without cause. The suit named plaintiffs in the case, Mayor and Police Commissioner Ted Wheeler, the City of Portland, and about 50 unidentified police officers are listed as the defendants. The alt-right group Patriot Prayer conducted the protest, and a larger crowd of counter-protesters accompanied it. This is the first of several lawsuits the ACLU is filing against the PPB for their actions against protesters.
If by protesting you faced a possible 60 years in prison, would you still protest? The Trump administration is hoping your answer is no. Trials began today for 200 protesters, journalists, and legal observers arrested at Trump's January 20th inauguration. Each arrestee is charged with 60 years for allegedly urging a riot, breaking less than 10 windows, and conspiracy charges. Lawyers say it is highly unusual for police to bring such strong charges against protesters who were kettled en masse and to bring the same charges against all of them, including legal observers and journalists. The ACLU has cited infringements of First Amendment rights in regards to police at the protests indiscriminately arresting protesters, using pepper spray, concussion grenades, and stingers extensively, and holding people outdoors for hours without access to food, water, or bathrooms.
Kevin Neal, 43, has been identified as the gunman who injured at least 10 people across seven different locations in Rancho Tama, California, and killing four of them. Neal was killed after police pinned his vehicle and fired into the car. While sheriff's officials have yet to release specific information, Neal was referred to in a call about domestic violence the same day that Neal's wife is believed to have been killed, which was the day before his rampage. Neal was also served with a restraining order last January following an assault in which he stabbed a neighbor during a dispute. In the days leading up to the rampage, Neal's neighbors reported hearing hundreds of rounds being fired. Sheriff Phil Johnson described the events as random.
A group of House Democrats today introduced five articles of impeachment accusing President Donald Trump of obstructing justice, violating the Foreign Emoluments Clause, undermining the freedom of the press, and other constitutional breaches. Impeachment sponsor Luis Gutierrez of Illinois said, "When I see a crime, I call 911. I don't stop to build consensus among my neighbors. If a crime is committed, you convene a grand jury, and in this case, that is the House Judiciary Committee, and we need to get started." Billionaire environmentalist Tom Steyer's petition calling for Trump's impeachment has garnered over a million signatures.
Know Your City is an organization that engages the public in art and social justice through creative pursuits and artistic placemaking projects. The programs and publications produced aim to educate people and share knowledge in order for them to better know their communities while empowering them to take action. Know Your City is holding its second annual fundraising gala tomorrow with the theme in Untold Stories at EcoTrust, which is at 721 Northwest 9th, and KBU Zelles Marchant spoke with Interim Executive Director Lydia Grujalva to find out more.
Okay, I have Lydia Grujalva, the Interim Executive Director at Know Your City on the line, here to talk to us about a very special gala. Lydia, what's happening over there at Know Your City?
Hey, so yeah, thanks for asking. So we have our gala, it's tomorrow, and it's our second annual Untold Stories Gala. So basically, it's going to be a night of just talking about Portland, you know, getting to know what's going on in the city. We're going to have a really special night. Our gala is, I mean, I'm a little biased, but I'm pretty sure it's one of a kind. We're going to have comedians, storytellers, and poets. And then we're also going to have, it's just going to be a really awesome night. So that's tomorrow.
That sounds like a wonderfully delicious time. So tell us, who are some of the poets? Who are some of the musicians? Give us some of the details.
Yeah, so we're going to have, we're actually going to be emceed by Carlos the Rollerblader and Jen Tam, who are famous for hosting You Can Do Anything. We're also going to have, we're going to have a few different people. Oh, and the headliners, as you would say, for music, we're going to have a live band, the Doo Doo Funk All-Stars. So they're going to be blessing us with their music, and it's going to be a really good time.
That sounds fabulous. We've had Carlos the Rollerblader on KBU earlier this year.
Oh, that's awesome.
They are a riot.
They're pretty famous. Oh, we're lucky.
They're just so incredible. It was a very incredible interview involving their phone line, their 24-hour call line they have. You can call.
Yeah, their advice line.
Their advice line. That's right. That was really something to talk about. So, and is there going to be, you know, food? Is there a special attire? Is it like, you know, should we wear black ties?
Right. So, I mean, I've been telling people it's Portland fancy. So I feel like people are going to still be showing up in jeans. So don't be too stressed about it. But you can get as fancy as you want to. I still don't know what I'm going to wear, but I know it's going to be fancy. yeah, we're going to have food. We're so lucky. We're going to be catered by Obon, which is a little company run by a Japanese woman and her partner. And they make vegan Japanese comfort food. So we are so excited to have them.
Delicious. That sounds wonderful. And what time does it start? Where is this gala located?
Good question. So it starts at 5:30, and it's located at EcoTrust downtown. So once you get into EcoTrust, there'll be some signs. We're on, I think, like the second floor, but you'll find us easy. Okay. And then, we actually have something really special going on right now with our tickets. So thanks to being in such a supportive community, we were able to offer, I think there are 15 tickets left at a sliding scale or pay what you can price. So those tickets are they're available to the public. You can just go onto the Know Your City Facebook page and the Eventbrite page, donate. It can be anywhere, you know, whatever it's worth to you. and it includes all the food, all the drinks, all the entertainment. And we're actually going to be giving away to some KBOO listeners a couple of our VIP seats in the front.
That's right. They can call our air room while the news is running, and we can take the first four callers and their names and pass them on to Know Your City, and you can have a VIP table, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's going to be right in the front. You'll get to see, get to be in a front row, enjoying all the poetry, all the music, and it's going to be a real good time.
Sounds wonderful. So when is dinner served? Is this kind of the kind of event where you don't want to show up too early, like, but no one's going to hate you if you do? You know, maybe you want to saunter in maybe around 6 or 7. I mean, what's the itinerary like?
Right. So it's a good long and packed afternoon or evening or whatever, whatever time is. So we're going to actually start right off the bat at 5:30. We'll have some time to get some raffle tickets. We have some really awesome raffle prizes, including our Know Your City Oregon History comic set and a bunch of other stuff. We're also debuting some of our zines that are written by some of the young people who work with Know Your City. One is about foster care. One is about experiencing racism on a walk in Portland. And so we'll have time to get raffle prizes and drinks and settled in. And then right at the beginning, we're going to actually, I'm going to be interviewed. So if you want to get to know more about the new interim executive director, which is me, you can come in right at the start and learn a little bit more about what we're doing, how we're growing, how this year's been. And then we're just going to cut into the fun stuff. Comedy starting right away. And then I think it's just like comedy and poetry. Then we have our youth awards at about, I think it's 7:15, so when we're going to start giving away awards to community leaders and especially young people who are really shaping the future of Portland. I'm like crying thinking about it because it's really great. We know some special young people. And then Doo Doo Funk starts playing at 8, and then we just dance the rest of the day. So that's kind of the itinerary.
That sounds wonderful.
Nine.
Great. And I want to make sure for those who are just tuning in, or maybe they just aren't aware, who Know Your City is and what your organization is all about. Do you want to fill folks in?
Yeah, totally. So Know Your City, we've been around since 2009. Some of you might remember us as the Dill Pickle Club. So in 2012, we changed our name to Know Your City. And we do tours and publications about things that are happening in Portland right now, little known facts about Portland history. And basically our main goal is to amplify untold stories, you know, the stories of people who are left out of the narrative. So people of color, LGBTQ, we're starting to do a lot more around disabled advocacy as well, because I'm disabled and obviously care about that. We're doing lots of stuff with that right now. We're mostly focusing on publications because not exactly tour weather, but we'll have some tours coming up for Thanksgiving weekend. We're in schools throughout Portland too, so we do a lot of work with artists and historians, and we also do most of our programming with young people, so people at 6 different majority minority high schools around Portland.
I love Know Your City. I know I say this every time we talk because I have the history books, the history little zines.
Right.
Yeah.
And last time I talked to you, you were like, oh, that's where these are from.
Yeah, I was really excited because I love those and even have gone to Wordstock to seek them out.
Did you know we actually have a second series coming out this year?
Yes, because you told me that the last time. And I was like, because I was like, you should really come out with another one. You're like, well, guess what? We are.
We heard you thinking it, and we're working on it. We so far have one about the Hung Far Low restaurant written by Simon Tam, who is who's on our board and really involved in the community as an activist. And then we have 9 more coming out. So
it's so cool.
We'll see more about that at the gala.
It's the coolest. We need creative approaches to history. History is incredible, and it's just wonderful that Know Your City is doing something to raise that up and giving youth a platform.
Oh, I was just about to say, I always tell my kids that I was the worst student because we didn't ever cover my history in school. I'm Native and we didn't really talk about that. So I was an awful student and my entire goal is to go and find the little angry people. I mean, not even angry, but the people whose stories aren't being told in their school programming, mm-hmm. and make sure that basically Know Your City exists to give people tools to actually tell these stories and these oral histories and to do the research to support the stories that, like, they know from their family. So, yeah, it's great. I love it. I'm biased, but I think it's great.
I think it's a good bias to have. So as we're wrapping up, why don't you tell folks one more time about the gala, like where, what, when, why, and how, and about the giveaway?
Perfect. Yeah. So our gala, Know Your City's second annual Untold Stories Gala, is going to be tomorrow at 5:30 to 9 at EcoTrust. And you can actually snag one of our remaining tickets by going to our Facebook or Eventbrite. They are sliding scale, pay what you can. You just go in and make a donation, and just like that, you're on the list. It comes with hors d'oeuvres and an open bar. And so then another way you can show up is you can actually call into KBOO, and we have 4 tickets to give away for our VIP section. So hopefully we'll see you there.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking time to share your gala on KBOO.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
That was KBOO's Zelles Marchant speaking with Know Your City's Interim Executive Director, Lydia Gruhalva, about the organization's second annual gala tomorrow. If you would like a shot at getting one of the 4 VIP seats to the gala, you better call soon because I see the lines are already lighting up. Call our air room here at KBOO at 503-231-8187.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's What's Life Without Laughter. That's followed at 6:30 by Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, it's Combined Culture Radio. In tonight's weather, the rain continues with a low of 43. Today in history, 60 years ago in 1957, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev claimed that the Soviet Union has a missile superiority over the United States and challenged America to a missile shooting match. The quote of the day is from painter and sculptor Georgia O'Keeffe, whose 130th birthday is today. "I've been absolutely terrorized every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Health advocates from Indian country discussed climate change at the recent American Public Health Association conference in Atlanta. Native people shared how tribal communities are being impacted. Melinda Tuhus reports.
April Taylor is a sustainability scientist for the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. Taylor works with 68 tribes across New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana on issues such as tribal water rights, sea level rise, flooding, droughts, and wildfires. She says another problem is the changing calendar for the appearance of different species, including those that tribal nations rely on for food or cultural uses.
When there's an indigenous phenology network, and phenology is basically the timing of the seasons and when things change, and so they're seeing some of those changes happening, you know, months earlier, and so they're trying to figure out if that, what that means for their culture, for the communities. Do we change the ceremony?
Michael Brubaker works for the Alaska Native Health Consortium. Brubaker says the 374 residents of Kivalina on an island in the far north of Alaska are facing threats from climate change. Their village is eroding and relocation efforts are underway.
Typically in winter, the community is frozen in, protecting the village from winter storm surge. However, in recent years, the freeze-up has been delayed or has not occurred at all. This exposes the coastline to extreme storm events.
Brubaker says relocation will cost an estimated $1 million per household, and in the meantime, residents plan to build a rock barrier to provide a modicum of protection and take other steps to promote resiliency. The conference attracted 12,000 public health professionals and students, mostly from the U.S., but also from 40 other countries. For National Native News, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
A U.S. Army combat veteran in South Dakota is training shelter dogs to act as service animals for veterans who suffer with post-traumatic stress disorder. As Jim Kent reports, Super Dogs for Superheroes also includes goals to reach Native American veterans.
Becky Flanagan was an ammunition specialist during the first Gulf War and came home with PTSD. She's created an organization to match dogs in need of a home with veterans like herself in need of emotional support. Flanagan's own dog, Molly, is the reason she was able to adjust from the after effects of combat and get a job.
When you have PTSD, crowds can be very difficult, and a dog can be trained to do things that make you think about where you are, so that if you are in a flashback, they can snap you out of it.
And since the Veterans Administration doesn't provide or pay for PTSD service dogs, having an organization like Flanagan's is a huge plus for those who couldn't otherwise afford it. Maria Ramos is Lakota from the Pine Ridge Reservation. The retired physician's assistant and former U.S. Army nurse helps Flanagan with her training program. Ramos says there are many Native veterans, especially those who served in Vietnam, who need help.
Dogs are really understanding, I think, and they help people because then you have to care about something else.
The bottom line, says Becky Flanagan, is that pairing a service dog with a veteran suffering with PTSD is good for everyone involved, the veteran, his or her family, and their community. I'm Jim Kent.
The Washington Post reports Gavin Clarkson, a Trump administration appointee in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, resigned this week. The resignation comes after a recent scathing report on a failed loan guarantee program, which Clarkson had ties to. Clarkson was appointed to serve as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in June with expertise in economic development and finances. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Thursday, November 16th, is a Nabisco boycott day of action. 600 American workers lost their jobs in Chicago, making Nabisco snacks like Oreos, Ritz crackers, and Chips Ahoy cookies. Nabisco Mondelez outsourced their jobs making those snacks to Mexico. On November 16th, there will be actions around the country boycotting these Nabisco products and urging that these American jobs be brought back. On Veterans Day, Will Attig, head of the Union Veterans Council, went with laid-off veteran Nabisco workers to see CEO Irene Rosenfeld, who, by the way, made $16.7 million last year as she sent American jobs to Mexico.
We're here to deliver a letter to the CEO asking her to bring back jobs that she sent to Mexico. We've got laid-off veteran workers here.
But the CEO refused to meet with the workers, sending an assistant down to the workers instead.
So you're refusing to let veterans come in and talk to somebody and have an actual conversation.
For more information about the Nabisco boycott, go to fightforamericanjobs.org. Since 2010, Republican-controlled state legislatures, not content just to attack worker rights with state laws at the state level, have been preempting pro-worker laws at the local level. The Economic Policy Institute has a new interactive map online tracking these labor rights preemption laws nationwide. It's called Worker Rights Preemption in the U.S., a map of the campaign to suppress worker rights in the states. It's available at epi.org. These preemptive laws used by GOP legislatures to bar localities from enacting pro-worker agendas include issues like minimum wage, paid leave, fair work schedules, prevailing wages, and project labor agreements. EPI says with inaction at the federal and state level, working people have increasingly relied on local government to raise labor standards. Now those protections are being stripped away by mostly conservative state legislators through the widespread use of preemption laws. The California Nurses Association is protesting plans to close Community Hospital in Long Beach. The Nurses Union is joining with community activists who want to keep the hospital open. The nurses say closing the hospital will have a severe health impact on the community. Memorial Health Systems, with profits of nearly $1 billion since 2010, says it must close due to problems with seismically retrofitting the hospital. The Nurses Union, though, says that no study data has been publicly provided to back up the hospital's sudden announcement that the facility must close within a few months. CNA says without Community Hospital Long Beach, local patients are left living in a healthcare desert. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers. Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now for a daily national newscast by Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, November the 15th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. Another mass shooting on today's nationwide rundown. Also, widespread voter registration violations reported in Arizona. A look at why new business creation is on the decline in the U.S. And get ready, get set, give. Now our top story, the Washington Post reports a gunman shooting at random locations killed four people Tuesday in Northern California, targeting an elementary school and a woman driving her children to school during the rampage. By the Post tally, 10 people were injured and taken to area hospitals, including at least two children, one of whom was at the elementary school. Police said no children were among those killed in the shooting. The Post notes this latest burst of gunfire followed deadly mass shootings in Nevada and in Texas. President Donald Trump may not be interested in keeping the United States in the Paris climate deal, but Mary Sherman's been checking out several Pennsylvania cities who say they are.
Tuesday was a still-in day of action, and rallies in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia were among the hundreds held around the nation to show a commitment to meeting the standards to reduce carbon emissions by 2050. Sustainability Director for the City of Philadelphia, Christine Knapp, says it's time for Pennsylvania to move away from its history of dirty energy.
We're trying to change our future to one that's more just and healthy and fair and affordable for folks, one that's really revolved more around clean energy sources that don't contribute to carbon emissions and don't contribute to air pollution. Having Pennsylvania take the stand is really important.
More than 2,500 leaders representing businesses, colleges, cities, and states have signed that we are still in declaration in support of climate action. After President Trump used the line of Pittsburgh, not Paris, to justify the withdrawal from the Paris deal, Pittsburgh Mayor William Peduto vowed his city would be 100% powered by clean energy by 2030 and lead by example.
It's a pretty long list. Allentown, Ambler, Bethlehem, Easton, Ferguson Township, Lancaster, Swarthmore, and West York Borough join Pittsburgh and Philadelphia as cities that have declared a commitment to support local climate action. The ACLU of Arizona released a report on Tuesday alleging widespread violations of the National Voter Registration Act that could have hindered registration for tens of thousands of low-income Arizonans.
Federal law requires the Motor Vehicle Division to automatically update voter registrations when someone changes their address, but researchers found many instances where the agency dropped the ball. ACLU staff attorney Darrell Hill says public assistance agencies are also supposed to take proof of citizenship from their clients and update county records so their voter registration can be processed.
People are putting in applications at some of these public assistance agencies. They think they're going to be registered to vote, but on the back end with the county recorder's office, they're not actually being registered to vote.
The report found that public assistance agencies have seen a 60% drop in voter registrations over the past 15 years, despite an increase in the number of people applying for assistance. The report alleges systemic violations, but not any intent to keep people from registering. Hill notes, for example, that the MVD is supposed to automatically offer the voter registration application, but instead gives it only upon request. The report says the official website, Service Arizona, does not automatically update voter rolls when people change their address, and the report accuses Access and DES of failing to offer all clients the voter registration application. In a statement, Secretary of State Michelle Reagan promised to meet with the ACLU and agency managers to review procedures to ensure compliance with the law. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Over the past decade, there's been a net decline in the creation of new business in the U.S. Tim Morrissey examines a new survey that suggests one of the contributing factors appears to be a growing aversion to risk by younger adults.
The survey was conducted by the accounting firm Ernst & Young for Junior Achievement. Ed Grachowski, a senior vice president of Junior Achievement, says the survey showed a broad gap between the attitudes of parents and teens regarding entrepreneurship.
The survey results from Ernst & Young showed that 88% of parents would be willing to support their teens if they had a desire to start their own business or to become entrepreneurs.
Groschalski says the teens identified risk as one of the top reasons they were hesitant to start a business on their own. He points out that these teens grew up during the Great Recession, which is likely another factor in their reluctance to take on risk. He says entrepreneurs are the driving force behind economic growth in the U.S.
And finally, Lori Stern tells us this Thursday, November the 16th, is Give to the Max Day in the state of Minnesota.
It's the day more than 6,000 Minnesota nonprofit groups stand to gain millions of dollars in donations, thanks to the organization known as GiveMN. Its executive director, Jake Blumberg, says the GiveMN website makes donating easy and fun, and has even gained an international following.
Give to the Max Day acts almost as an unofficial starting gun to year-end giving season. We get donations from every county in the state of Minnesota, every state in the United States, and nearly 50 countries from around the world.
GiveMN does add a 6.9% fee for processing the online donations and running the program. Donors can browse potential recipients by mission.
Gwen and Kim Scriver are the caretakers of Grizzly Reservoir, just east of Aspen. Their job is to maintain the reservoir and the creeks that flow into it, as well as the four-mile tunnel that sends the water east to the Front Range. Setting aside the heated politics of moving resources from one basin to another, the tunnel is an engineering triumph. And for many months of the year, the couple's only link to civilization. H2O Radio has their story.
Glenn and Kim Scriver are the nicest people you could ever meet, the kind of people you'd love to have as neighbors. Considerate, handy, friendly, and funny, only if you lived next door to them, your driveway would be 4 miles long through a narrow tunnel barely wide enough to fit a car and one that actively carries water. Glenn and Kim are the caretakers of Grizzly Reservoir just east of Aspen, and the tunnel is, for many months of the year, their only link to civilization. It's also a crucial linchpin in a very complex plumbing system of ditches, canals, and storage that transports water west of Colorado's Continental Divide, east to thirsty cities along the Front Range. And it's on the east side of the tunnel where my co-producer Jamie and I have arranged to meet them to learn more about their unusual job. We've parked on the side of the creek and we're staring intently at the entrance to the tunnel that has a no trespassing sign and a metal gate to keep the curious away. We more expect to see a boat emerge than a car, but after a few minutes we hear splashing sounds getting louder and louder until finally we see headlights and then a Honda appears from the opening.
Sorry, we're late.
We're all there. No worries.
Hey, hi.
No worries. How you guys run into traffic on the way or something?
Yeah.
Before the Scrivers left home this morning, they had to close a gate to stop the water from flowing through the tunnel, an idiosyncrasy of their lifestyle that we're about to experience firsthand as we climb into their car to make the return trip. It will be a drive under a mountain that will take nearly 15 minutes to complete.
Are you nervous?
Oh. He is.
It's a walk in the park.
Wow, we're in a pipe.
Yep. It's about 4 miles long, straight as a gun barrel in here.
So you can let go of the steering wheel?
Yeah, it's, see, there's driving shelves on the side, and then there's a trough in the middle, so you pretty much, it'll kind of keep you centered in there.
It's, of course, completely dark in here if Glenn were to turn off his lights, which we've been warned he does to humor nervous visitors. The tunnel is actually a 9.5-foot diameter concrete pipe built in the 1930s and paid for by farmers from the town of Ordway on the southeast plains of Colorado. Glenn says it was built by unemployed mine workers and was an engineering triumph.
They blasted it out from both sides, which is amazing back then. And they met in the middle and were 9 inches off from each other.
The tunnel is part of the Independence Pass Trans Mountain Water Diversion System and is still owned and operated by the Twin Lakes Reservoir and Canal Company based in Ordway. In the late 1970s, municipalities were looking for water, so now the cities of Colorado Springs, Aurora, and Pueblo own most of the rights. When the gates are open, water will rush east through the tunnel to Twin Lakes Reservoir. From there, it flows into the Arkansas River and eventually to faucets some 150 miles away. Driving through the tunnel feels more like being in a boat than a car, and in fact, occasionally they see fish jumping in the few inches of water left along the bottom. Every so often, a big splash of water will smack the windshield from inlets in the ceiling that relieve pressure from springs up above.
How often do you all make the trip?
At least once a week.
That's it?
Well, sometimes, I mean, we used to have our son went to school out in and out of here every day for a few years, so it just depends what's going on, what time of year it is. In May and June, we can't come through here because there's so much water we can't ever shut it off.
It's not long before we see what we hope might be the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel, but it turns out to be a reflection of our headlights.
Okay, so that's just a reflection on a tunnel gate.
Oh, that's where the water comes in?
That's where the water comes in. So we're like 20 feet below the top of the water level right now.
Glenn makes a hard left up a ramp and pushes a button to open his garage door. We daylight into a setting of pure Colorado mountain beauty, and before us is the reservoir, aqua blue and sparkling in the morning sun. The lake collects water from several creeks in this 54 square mile watershed. Those creeks are funneled into systems that each have culverts, spillways, and gates of their own, and it's the scriver's job to keep them flowing. In fact, we've met them in their busy season. Fall is when they do much of their maintenance and repair work on the system. That can range from cleaning out diversions and canals to grading the 25 miles of road like the one we're driving on now. They're also responsible for charting how water is moving through the system.
We take these charts and Kim has to goes through every 2 hours and writes down what the water amount is, and then we average them up for a day. And yeah, you have to show due diligence on your water. You got to prove that what's coming in, where it's going, how you're using it, you know.
Yeah.
The simplicity yet sophistication of the system is impressive. And Glenn thinks it would be good if folks on the Front Range could see what it takes to deliver their water.
You know, we have, like I said, a few tours have come up. People are pretty amazed by, you know, how things all work. And this whole system, there's not one pump on the whole system. It's all gravity flow. So
eventually, the snow will start to fly, and they'll switch to their winter routine, which is a bit more relaxed. They'll spend their time measuring snowpack and repairing heavy equipment like their bulldozer and front-end loader. They'll put those into use in the spring, clearing roads that will likely be under snowdrifts at least 9 feet deep. For Kim, this is the part of their gig that's not her favorite.
The scariest part of the job, for me at least, is we plow out in the first part of May. While he's in the dozer, I'm kind of cleaning up behind him, pushing snow off the sides.
Try not to look.
Yeah.
I know. When you're up high on loader, you can see over.
Kim laughs. It's the time when she gets caught up on her prayers. Still, she and Glenn wouldn't trade this job for anything. They clearly love each other's company and the beautiful setting they share. And frankly, they joke, if they did ever have a spat and threatened to storm out, they'd have to wait 2 hours for the tunnel to drain.
2 hours, they're up here, just forget what you were even leaving for.
Yeah. We love it up here. It's nice. I mean,
bet.
If you like this climate and this, you know, kind of surrounding, the last two guys that did this job died up here, so that's kind of our plan, yeah.
That's a good plan.
We'll see how it goes.
To see videos and photos of the tunnel, visit our website at h2oradio.org. From the Continental Divide in Colorado, I'm Franny Halperin.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and James Sneed. The producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer tonight is David Kesters. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelzelz Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with guest host Carrion Amory from the Native American Youth and Family Center discussing mental health in the Native community, plus the intersection of environmental justice and education. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fagerang details the inside story of the Saudi Night of Long Knives, the preemptive coup by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Ray Armantrout about her new book, Partly, a collection of her most brilliant pieces that affirms her reputation as a sharp and innovative writer. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Good evening, this is Mike Crenshaw, and I am with you again for our weekly news segment called News from the Boo. Myself or the other co-manager, Delphine Crescenzo, will bring you this segment from 5:45 p.m. to 6 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio every Wednesday from the late afternoon going into the evening. I have two very special guests with me tonight. I've got MC Grown and C4 the Prodigy from True Original Beings, both of whom are members of the hip-hop community in Portland and Vancouver in the metro area and have previously been part of KBOO's Hip-Hop Youth Collective. How's it going, Curtis?
Oh, it's going real good today. I'm just been enjoying life, you know. I'm very excited about the future events that we have coming up this month and in the future. And a lot of big things are going on right now.
Right on, man. What's up, C4 the Prodigy, a.k.a. Cliff?
Well, nothing. Just constantly, you know, working on this music. Getting the vibe right, letting everybody know what's going on. Just kind of getting people familiar with the movement that we're bringing in. Really trying to X out the garbage music. So sick and tired of hearing music that it's like bringing down the community with drugs and crime. And, you know, they think that they're bringing good, you know, to the community, but it's not, as damaging communities. So we're trying to create music and bring a vibe that is going to let people